House Committee on Revenue for April 15th, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, I assume that given that this is the Revenue Committee, you have all completed, signed, and mailed your tax returns and are ready to get on with the business of the committee. And that is, today is the opening the work session on House Bill 2070, which we open now. Paul, did you want to describe for us the Dash One Amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. You heard 2070 last week, and you heard a description of the Dash One Amendment. So that's the amendment before you now, one of the amendments. There are really four elements to it. The first is it changes the allocation mechanism for the gain share calculation. Under current law, it goes into a shared service fund, and DAS then distributes that back to the taxing districts. Under the Dash One or 2070, the Department of Revenue estimates that revenue coming out of unreceded revenue. It does not go into the general fund, and then it's distributed out to the specified purposes in the bill. So there's a little different funding mechanism involved. The Dash One also changes the gain share calculations. It imposes a cap of $10 million per biennium on any individual county, and it limits the calculation to newly created jobs. As you recall, in current law, under the shared service fund calculation, it's both retained jobs and newly created jobs identified with the strategic investment program or the eligible SIP program. So those two changes are made. And the other thing that the amendment does is extends the sunset. It's currently 1/1/19. It would extend it to 1/1/2025. And I do have a revenue impact statement. There should be a revenue impact statement
somewhere in there.
Yes, we've got a lot from the last meeting, I think. There it is. This measure would take effect for the beginning of the coming biennium, the 15-17 biennium. Under current law, there's an estimated about $94.9 million that will go through the shared service fund and be allocated out to the eligible districts. This bill would reduce that to about $18.6 million. So that's primarily comes from limiting the calculation to newly created jobs and not including the retained jobs. So it's about 20% of what the total estimate currently is. So I applied that proportion to the forecast going forward. So under this proposal, the Dash One, there'd be a $76 million increase in the general fund estimate or a shift to the general fund compared to the shared service fund. Now, the SIP income tax revenue allocated would drop by 76.3. In other words, it was allocated through the shared service fund. Instead of being 94.9, it would be 18.6. In 17-19, the revenue impact's a little complicated because you have the sunset in there. There's only 1 year of allocation, which is about $66 million under current law, which is allocated through the shared service fund. Under this measure, there would be an extension to a full 2 years, but of course with a much smaller amount. So the net result would still be a gain to the general fund of $38 million, and then a reduction of $38 million to what's under current law being allocated through the shared service fund. And then going forward, 1919 to 21, you have a negative for the general fund of $28.6 million. That's because under current law, nothing is allocated because of the sunset. And then there would be $28.6 million is what would be run through the formula. The impact of the formula, you can see in the next box there. These are the allocations that are specified in the Dash One. Washington County is the only county that is at the limit, and they would receive $10 million each biennium. All the other local tax districts, the wage calculations for the other non-Washington County districts are all from newly created jobs. All the retained jobs are in Washington County. So basically what we did is project that out at roughly 6% annually. assuming that there would be wage growth and perhaps some additional growth for those facilities. So that other local tax districts for 15-17 are the same as current law. And then there's also a provision in the measure that if you calculate the 18.6 million from the newly created jobs, and then the cap of 10 million for one county, any remainder from that calculation goes to the state school fund to be allocated through the school distribution formula. And you can see in 15-17, that's estimated at about 7.9 million. 17-19 is about 14.6 million. So one thing I will say about these estimates, the Business Oregon has just received the this current year data from the participants in the SIP program, the eligible SIP. So they're calculating that. So we'll get a new estimate, and that from those numbers, the state economist will estimate the current law amount that would be paid out in August of this year under current law. So we currently estimate that about $42 million. So that may change with the May 15 forecast when the state economist builds in the new Business Oregon data.
Great. Questions for Paul? Representative Davis?
We'll have an opportunity to talk about the Dash 2s at some point.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Smith Warner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, those updated projections, would those be impacted by this? I'm trying to wrap my head exactly around the effective date. I mean, it says on passage. So I'm just not sure where in the cycle, like, is right now where we're going to do it for last year, so those numbers wouldn't be impacted, that would still go out. Can you give me a better sense of that, please?
Representative Smith-Warner, it would go... it would impact the distribution for the 15-16 fiscal year. That calculation has to be completed in May, and then it's distributed out to the counties after August 15th, but before September 15th. So that is the first calculation that would be affected. So it would impact both fiscal years in the coming biennium. Now, in terms of the Dash 1, you would probably see very limited impact on the counties themselves because Washington County is at the cap under this proposal, and any effect in the total amount may affect the general fund impact and may affect the state school fund residual calculation.
Okay. Thank you.
Making sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Representative Davis, you want to describe the Dash 2?
Thank you, Chair, very much. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with this committee about the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments are Senate Bill 129 as amended with the Dash 5s verbatim, which is currently sitting in Ways and Means, was passed out of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. It's the result of about a six-week bipartisan, bicameral work group that I took part in and called by the Senate Finance and Revenue Chair, Senator Haass, Senator Devlin, Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Hansel, Representative Gallegos, and myself took part in. This version, the Dash 2 to House Bill 2070, first of all, recognizes that changes in the gain share program are needed. It makes a 60% reduction in the local share for the local governments. Currently, they receive 50% of the calculated gain share payments. This would reduce that to 20% of the gain share payments. It retains 80% at the state level. With that 80%, 50%, the original 50%, is allocated to the general fund as it currently is in statute. So we're really talking about that 30% that's been reduced to the locals. And what this bill will do with that 30% is make a dedication to the state school fund, which in the first biennium would be roughly $30 million, make a dedication to the Career Technical Education Revitalization Grant Program, which would be about $14.8 million in the first biennium, and make a dedication to the OSU statewide extension services in the same amount. Now, we're getting into a lot of percentages. If you'd like to see what those look like visually, you're welcome to open up the Senate Bill 129 record. Under both the analysis and meeting materials, there is a chart breaking it down. Again, going through, 50% is retained to the state. The locals only get 20%. We're talking about that additional 30% that's kept with the state. 30% of that, roughly $28.5 million, state school fund. 15%, roughly $14.5 million, career technical education. And the remaining 15%, roughly $14.5 million, to OSU statewide extension services program. It also includes advancement of the sunset on the gain share program as well. And that, in sum, is what it does.
Okay, and
I'm happy to take any technical questions about that amendment.
Well, and that was Senate Bill 129?
Senate Bill 129, okay. A.
Okay. So if you go to that bill, you can review the revenue estimate, the revenue impact statement on 129A. And it sets these numbers out in ways that are, as Representative Davis said, easier to read. Any questions for Representative Davis on the Dash 2? Let me just simply note that based on the testimony we had last time, it's the desire of the chair that we move the Dash 1 amendment and then send the bill with a due pass and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Vega Peterson?
Chair Barnhart, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2070 with a due pass recommendation and a substantive referral.
Well, let's deal with the amendment first.
Oh, I'm sorry. I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2070.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2070. Is there further discussion? Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think it'll be a surprise. I've been following the work of the work group, and I prefer that that approach. So it'll be a no on this motion.
Thank you. I'd like to note that I expect there'll be a considerable conversation in the Ways and Means Committee, and the allocation issue of technical education, coordinating council, the state school fund, and these other things that are contained in Senate Bill 129, I'm certain will be considered. I probably favor some of them. I just want to let you know that I don't think the allocation is by any stretch set. What this really does is it gets a conversation started in the Ways and Means Committee. Any other discussion on the Dash 1s? We better call the roll. I have at least one who said he's going to vote no.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
No.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Megan Peterson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz?
No.
Chair Barnhart?
Chair votes aye. The motion fails, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2070. We'll open a public hearing on Representative Fagan's bill. Let's see, what is that, 3086? Thank you. Public hearing on House Bill 3086. Thank you for coming today.
I mean, you want to come up, Jim?
Thank you very much. I'm going to have my constituents come up as well.
Thank you. Representative Fagan. Oh, excuse me. Let's hear from the staff.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3086 would require the city of Damascus to distribute to ad valorem property taxpayers all excess monies remaining in city funds after satisfying all the outstanding legal debts and obligations of the city. And it would take effect only of House Bill 3085, which would disincorporate the city. If that bill is approved by the majority of people voting in the next regular general election
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. And the description is correct that this is basically half of a bill that together probably makes a little bit more sense. That bill, all of you at least who are present on that day, have already passed on to the Senate. So House Bill 3085 passed unanimously off the House floor a few weeks ago. Representative Kenemer and I are chief co-sponsors. He's not able to be with us here today. So what that bill does is puts the question of disincorporation to the voters of Damascus. I won't give you too much history because I know that this is a city that I think the history is well known through the newspapers, but the bottom line is the city incorporated 10 years ago in an effort to kind of have more control on its local process when Metro put the area, the community that was known as Damascus, into the urban growth boundary. Through that process, the city began to work towards a comprehensive plan, as cities do, had a planning commission, et cetera. But then there was strife within kind of the community and what was going on with that planning commission. And so a group of citizens put a charter amendment on the ballot that passed, saying the city to have a comprehensive plan, that comp plan had to first pass a vote of the people. To my knowledge, it's the only city in the state to ever have such a requirement, and probably for good reason, because now 10 years later, Damascus is without a comprehensive plan. I believe 7 of them have failed at the ballot. One as recently as about a month ago that failed 75-25. So it comes to a point where you want to call the question on whether or not it makes sense for Damascus to be a city. We believe that question is most appropriately put to the people that actually live there. So that's what House Bill 3085 does. Under a normal course, the money that is left in excess in the city's coffers would go to the county. 3086 changes that in this situation for a particular reason. This same group that put this charter amendment on requiring that a vote of the people is required for a comprehensive plan also put a charter amendment on that said the city cannot increase its city budget more than 3% over the 2010 budget without a vote of the people. And so basically the city has continued to collect revenues through property taxes, but has been unable to actually spend all of them because of a vote of the people. So in this particular situation, simply giving all of those funds to Clackamas County would provide quite a bit of a windfall to the county, because Damascus has a lot more excess funds than a city typically would that would simply disincorporate. So there's about $7 million that's at issue here, with for a little city is a significant amount. About $2 million of that is state tax, gas tax revenues, and about $5 million of it is city property tax revenues. We are in negotiations with the county to decide kind of what is the definition of excess, so we are working on an amendment. The county will have to employ 11.5 FTE for 1 year after the city disincorporates, and so we're accounting for that in there. There is a public safety contract with the Clackamas County Sheriff that we're obviously, we're kind of looking at whether that's an obligation of the city. For the $2 million that is city gas tax revenue, it doesn't make sense to redistribute that through the property tax, because that's not how it was paid. So we are looking at putting that into an escrow account that would be used by the county for road improvements, but only within the boundaries of the city that would have been incorporated Damascus. So that still is used for the good of the people of Damascus. So this bill would essentially say that of the excess that is left, that it's actually redistributed back to the property taxpayers through a formula outlined in this bill if House Bill 3085, the referral, passes the people. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my constituents who are going to perhaps correct anything that I've said in error and give you a little bit more flavor from folks who actually live in Damascus. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead. State your name for the record and give your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Representatives. My name is Jim Searing, and I'm a 53-year resident of the community of Damascus and the leader of one of our two large citizen groups called Citizens for Deannexation from Damascus. House Bills 3084 and 3085 both recently passed the House unanimously. Thank you all very much from the citizens of Damascus for your affirmative votes on those two bills. House Bill 3086 here today is just a companion bill to those previously passed bills. Our city was incorporated 11 years ago, not 10. 11 years ago, and after 11 years of eternal dysfunction, no state-mandated comprehensive plan, and empty promises from city councilors year after year after year, our people are done. 11 years' worth of taxes refunded to those who have paid them is the essence of this bill, and it makes sense. The same as the state kicker refund does when there are state surpluses. It's clear that the majority of Damascus voters don't want a city, and they vote down comp plan after comp plan with, as Representative Fagan mentioned, the last result in March was a 75% no vote. The city of Damascus will disincorporate at some point soon. It's an okay thing. It's a good thing. It's what our people want, whether it's through the people winning the Court of Appeals case on May 7th or the voters voting again in November 2016. Whether it's using House Bill 3085 and 86 or the current interpreted standard. By November 2016, our citizen group is extremely confident that the city will disincorporate through one of those means, so the actions of this bill will need to be implemented irregardless. The intent of this bill is to refund the leftover funds after the city disincorporates to the taxpayers who have paid them, instead of sending all of them to Clackamas County. It makes more sense, and our citizen group encourages a passage of this bill through the committee today. Thank you again for your support.
Good afternoon, committee representatives. My name is Chris Hawes. I'm a resident of Damascus, and I'm the communications director for the Citizens Committee for Disincorporation. We do appreciate the passage and all the role that you all played in 3084 and 3085. We would appreciate that same support for 3086. The people of Damascus in the last 11 years have paid somewhere between $30 and $35 million to deal with an impossible situation not of our making. We didn't ask to be brought into the urban growth boundary. We've tried our best to deal with what amounted to being a plan to lift an elephant, and it turns out it's not possible until there are some serious operational and statutory things changed. Damascus cannot grow. And in the meantime, the infighting that we've done amongst ourselves and the things that we've passed, the one thing that I would correct from Representative Fagan is that our spending limitation is even worse than she outlined, because it has a spend it or lose it provision. The Budget Committee just met last Wednesday night and passed a budget limitation that is $300,000 less than last year. The spending limitation says that if you don't spend it, it drops off, and then it can grow by the 2.5%. Last year, it dropped by 370,000. Basically, Damascus, one way or another, in the current form, it financially strangles in 4 to 5 years. When a group of us saw this was coming, we gathered the signatures, we placed an initiative on the ballot. The people voted 64% in an off-year election where we had the highest turnout in the state, 68%. It was 20 points higher than any election we've found anywhere else. But due to an interpretation that is inventive and unprecedented, they said that it didn't pass. One of my other hats is that I happen to be the plaintiff in the Court of Appeals case that goes for oral arguments on May 7th. When we had that campaign, we had to tell the people of Damascus that at that time $4 million was going to go back to the county. We were honest with them. It was used against us. We were told that it was irresponsible to allow that to happen. And now we're being told that 3086 is also irresponsible. So apparently we can't win. But we told the people that we didn't get that money to them because it was impossible. There was no way you could do it. I believe the poor guy at the tax assessor's office either thought we were dating or that he should get a stalking order against me, because I was calling the poor guy two or three times in a week asking him, what if? And he finally explained that apparently tax assessor's office are made to take in money, not give it back. Who knew? As it is,
you understand that well now, don't you?
He was pretty clear about it.
Yeah.
As it stands now, there is no future for Damascus. One way or another, the die is cast. It is going to end. This bill would allow the people to have part of, obviously, the $30 or $35 million is gone. We've spent it on attorneys, planning, all the other things that cities do. We've gone nowhere. Getting some of it back would certainly be a nice thing to make a bad situation a little less bad, and we would appreciate the committee's support.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Reed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question as just a gentle comment. I couldn't pass over the comment about the kicker as a surplus, given that we are potentially about to encounter that. I don't think anyone up here would look at it as a surplus. It's a miss on the forecast that we have to deal with, so a small point and nothing about the rest of your content. Thank you for being here for your testimony.
Yeah, we wish it were a surplus.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we need the money to, and we're not going to be able to use it. Representative Benz, please.
Nothing on the kicker. Forgive me if I missed this, but if the bill doesn't pass, if 3086 doesn't pass, is there a default provision? What happens if the bill doesn't pass again? Forgive me for not picking up on it earlier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, the default position is all the money goes to the county, and when you weren't here, the reason that we said in this particular situation that would amount to a windfall for the county in a way that's different if another city were to disincorporate is because of the spending limits that Mr. Haas described that went into effect in 2010. So the city hasn't been – so it's been taking in normal property tax revenues but unable to actually spend it. So they have a much more in excess funds than a typical city would to the kind of what the default rules were written to. So this is narrowly tailored to just this situation in Damascus, and we are working with the county to work on an amendment where they say, you know, because it says to redistribute the excess funds that are above and beyond the outstanding legal debts and obligations. So we're working with them to kind of define obligations, because under state law they do have to employ the city's employees for a year, and that's 11 FTEs. So we're working with them to work with those funds. And then there also is the matter of the city's contract with the sheriff that's ongoing that would be an obligation, at least for the term of that sheriff contract. And so we're working with them to define kind of what so they would still get some of that money, but what is actually excess would go back to the property taxpayers.
Yes, please.
Yeah, and that was exactly what I was asking. We have similar all these interrelationships between smaller cities in particular and our counties I'm from. And so I was just curious if that was being managed, and it sounds like it is. So thank you.
Right. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Thank you for being here. You know, I served as a Clackamas County Commissioner for an interval during the time when you folks have been experiencing this really challenging set of events, and I can sure sympathize with your feeling fed up and working hard to try to find a constructive set of next steps. So good work to try to make the best of a challenging situation as you are. My question is about what the county's position is on this bill. Did I miss it? Have they taken a position on this bill? I know you're in negotiations with them, but what is the current status?
I didn't see Chris Lyons here if he showed up, but he said that I could comfortably say that they believe that we're in good faith negotiations, and where we ultimately believe we'll end up with in the amendment, they don't have any problems with it. I believe that they'll come to a place of support, but I think their board has to actually vote on that, so I don't want to say that prematurely, but very much no contentious relationship, having a good negotiation. In fact, they originally, this bill actually, by the way, has already passed out of rural lands, this bill. It just got subsequently referred here. And we were expecting it was going to be passed on the House floor before we realized it was subsequently referred here, and they were at worst going to be neutral. I believe they actually went on record supporting 3084 and 3085 that went to the House floor, which is the companion part of this bill. So I don't want to speak for them and say they're supportive, but it definitely is a positive interaction that we're working with them in good faith.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes, please.
So is it the case that, given the lack of community-approved comprehensive plan, that the county will be in a position of needing to prepare a comprehensive plan for the city? And if so, will the cost of doing that work be part of the expenses? Because I guess the thing I would worry about is if the state were asked to come in and provide a chunk of money to help the county absorb the obligation to provide, again, the governance of Damascus area, even as at the exact same moment local community members' funds that would have kind of covered that work are being redistributed in the community.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leininger, that is exactly also part of the discussions with them. The 11 and a half FTE that they'll continue to employ, that they're going to have to pay under state law, we're kind of working out, well, you know, of those folks who has expertise, you know, if we're going to have to employ them for a year anyway, can they be helpful in that planning process to make the most use of the folks they already have to employ? So that is definitely a part of the negotiations that we're talking about with them to try and work out exactly, you know, what their costs will be. The bill that we are working on, we have a draft amendment, so I didn't bring it because it still is draft, but we do have a cap. Because as I said to them, I said, you know, my concern is that if you give people the entire $5 million, you know, as potential use, that it's easy to find $5 million worth of bills. And so we definitely are going to have some sort of cap that says up to a certain amount can be used by the county for these certain uses, so that there still is a certain, at least a certain amount going back to the property tax, to the property taxpayers. But that is exactly part of the negotiations that we're working with, because this is quite unprecedented. I think it was Boyd. It was the last city to disincorporate, obviously, which is pre-metro, pre-comprehensive plan. And so there's a lot of unprecedented things here about what, you know, what are the actual costs involved when a city disincorporates. And we're working in good faith with the county on that.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Sure. I have a couple. And forgive me, I haven't seen the other bills, so I don't really understand how this all fits together. And I guess our job is only to deal with the issue of what happens with the city's money if and when the citizens vote to disincorporate under one of the other bills. If I got that right so far? Okay. So the city has a variety of sources of money, one of them being property taxes, but it also receives state funds or state distributions from tobacco tax, the gasoline tax, and probably a variety of other things that don't come to mind right at the moment. Under the arrangement in this bill or somewhere else, what happens to those funds?
Mr. Chair, the gas tax in particular, the amendment that we're working out, and there's about $2 million in gas tax revenues, that we're talking about putting into an escrow account that can be used for the gas tax type purposes by the county, but only within the boundaries of the city of Damascus, you know, the former city of Damascus, assuming, so, you know, there's a stoplight out or a pothole that needs to be fixed or something, that those $2 million could be used by the county, but only within the boundaries of the city of Damascus as it exists at the time of disincorporation. The other question that
is that an amendment for this bill?
It will be an amendment for this bill, yes.
Okay. All right. Please, go ahead.
Yes. I believe so. There's actually, let me correct that, Mr. Chair. There is actually an amendment being prepared also for 3085, which is the one that already passed that we would amend on the Senate side. But they're all – so I'm on the top of my head, I'm forgetting which language is in which amendment, because the bills are kind of fused together.
Well, let me suggest that since this bill has to do with the distribution of the money, it ought to go in this bill.
Right.
Even if it's somewhere else, too.
Right.
Yeah. And then you were going to talk about the tobacco tax.
Mr. Chair,
when I interrupted you.
No, that part I have not. I don't have an answer for that yet. I think we're working with legislative council on that. The amounts, the agreement that we were coming to is the amounts that are fungible with property taxes and can kind of be used for general use. You know, you don't know whether those were the funds that were spent and the property taxes are withheld. So kind of the amounts that are fungible would be the ones that we would redistribute to property taxpayers. And any amounts that are not fungible and that have to be used for a particular purpose, that we would do the same thing that we're doing with the gas tax revenues, would be to put those in an escrow account to be used by the county, but for the purpose, for the benefit of kind of the former incorporated city boundaries. But we're still working with legislative council to determine which funds are fungible and which are not. I don't know if Mr. Hawes had
if
a comment
I might,
as well.
From a practical standpoint, the question is almost moot. Because of the lack of a comprehensive plan, last year LCDC, the penalty they imposed on us was the withholding of state shared funding. So we had spent what we had before. We didn't get last year. It's not looking good this year. So it's your point is a good one. But I don't think we necessarily have to worry about it because they refused to give it to us because we haven't passed a comp plan.
So there isn't $2 million.
There's $2 million in gas taxes. We're not getting the state revenue sharing for tobacco and whatever the other ones are.
Okay. Maybe one of you could get us the details on that. I just want to make certain that if this bill passes, that this will be a guide to whoever it is, it acts as trustee or whatever you're going to call it, to actually distribute the money, and that they can rely on a state statute that tells them exactly how to do it, so they don't have to wonder about that.
And that is a good point, Chair Barnhart. one of the things that I didn't mention was there, I know your legislative financial analyst received some information from the city finance director that he had some concerns with the timing and the timeline. And I wanted to explain that the timing is the same whether my lawsuit passes or, you know, whether I get a ruling in the Court of Appeals or disincorporates. The language in House Bill 3085 timing-wise mirrors what's in the existing Chapter 222 ORS version of disincorporation. So they're going to have 60 days to figure out what they should do. I've been suggesting that they not wait till the last minute. My mom always told me not to do that with my homework.
Thank you. Representative Betts?
Thank you, Chair. I think you may have just said it, but the winding up of these things, whether it's a corporation or whether it's a business or whether it's a whatever, there always seems to be unknowns, which of course we would hope the statute would address, but maybe not. And so you hate to, in the situations where I have been asked to give money back to stockholders with a C corporation and you know there's something out there, we generally set up the escrow perhaps and we don't send all the money out because we're so afraid of the unknown. And so since I don't want to have you guys coming back in 2 or 3 years and saying oops, to avoid that, I guess my question is, how do we avoid that? How do you avoid that so you're not back here at some point asking us to fill in some sort of a hole that we could have kept the money to fill it.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we had that same exact conversation with the county. While the affairs of the city under both existing law and our referral would have to be wrapped up within 60 days, we didn't put that same provision in this. And we would certainly be – this doesn't require the money is distributed within 60 days. And so – and we certainly, if it would make you more comfortable, we can say within a year or something like that so that it's clear it doesn't have to be distributed within the same period of time. Because, again, those 11 FTE that are working for the city will – still be working now for the county. So if there were excess things to be wrapped up, they will be employed by the county. They have to be for a year. So we didn't put that 60-day provision in here because we didn't want to have that exact problem. But we can certainly specify in this bill that you have up to a year to distribute that money back.
Yeah, please.
Okay. So of course, in the ones that I have done, never a city, thank goodness, but. A year is a very short period of time for all the unknowns to turn up. So we do all kinds of other things to try to cover those unknowns. Sometimes it's with insurance, sometimes it's with letters, sometimes with any number of indemnification agreements. We got all kinds of stuff we use. I'm just not hearing it here. So you hate to see the money go out the door within a year unless there's somebody saying you have identified, and people turn to the lawyers and demand that we give them letters saying that we know every possible bad thing that could happen. So I'm just asking, do we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I mean, we certainly can't say that we know whatever bad thing would happen. I think in comparison to the situations that you're describing with, like, a corporation rolling up, I think it would be more simplistic here because there aren't as many kind of interests at play. This is, you know, property taxes. This is city obligations that are, you know, and as Mr. Hawes said, I mean, if 3085 does pass this body and it can be referred, I think there is – every confidence that the measure that already passed 66-33 will pass even more overwhelmingly when they have the opportunity to get some of their property taxes back. And so and this bill also, to be clear, actually because of that concern, we limited it to only the property taxes paid between July 1st, 2013 and then the date of disincorporation. So you're not having to go back, which would be more complicated, to maybe everybody and whether property's been, you know, divided. We limited that period to basically the three previous property tax years, one of which will be, you know, funds that literally almost just have come in because at the time the city's wound up, their property taxes will be due. So basically be just shooting that check right back to people. And then, you know, so it shouldn't be as complicated, but we're certainly happy to give people as much time. We could put a provision in here that says that there's still things to be wound up. You know, there's a trigger that says you can take more time. I don't think that's, you know, that's something that people are disagreeing with. Ultimately, as long as the principle is that they do get their money back.
Another thing that I would hope you – I'm sorry, Representative Davis was next.
Thank you, Chair.
Not me. Please.
Thank you all for your testimony and for working on this bill and these issues for so long. This is maybe a out of left field question, so if you want time to answer it, that's fine, or to look at it. What happens with potential causes of action against the city of Damascus if it is disincorporated do those, considering the history of litigation with the city, do we know what would happen with those either existing causes of action or potential causes of action? Any ideas?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that was also brought up by the county in our negotiations. The language that we're using in the bill, you know, is legal debts and obligations, but obviously a cause of action is not yet a legal obligation. So that's something that we're working out. Certainly, at this point, there's none that they've identified. And again, it's a very small city, so at least it's not something as complicated as Portland or something. But certainly, you know, those that will need to be looked at as well, as that's all part of kind of winding up the affairs.
Thank you. This bill provides that the city shall distribute, line 6 and 7. The city ceases to exist 60 days after the election. I wonder if you need some kind of a trustee or some other entity to actually do the winding up. And if you do, whether that ought to be an amendment to this bill. I hate to add complexity, but I'm thinking about the lawyer's questions here, and it would certainly be most beneficial if we had clear instructions for a trustee in this bill, and a trustee who doesn't have to go away in 60 days can actually take the time to do the winding up, to deal with perhaps posting notices. If you have a claim against the city, got to tell me now, like we do in a state, in dealing with an estate closure or a bankruptcy. The more we think about it, the more complex it gets. But if we write the bill correctly, it ends up being simpler. Perhaps you could be thinking about that as you think about your amendment.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. No, and I actually, as soon as you said that, I noticed, I'm like, oh, if the city, because we intentionally did not put the 60-day timeline in here, but by putting the city shall distribute, you kind of de facto put that timeline in there.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
I will include that language. I mean, I think we've been putting most of that kind of trustee-type responsibility on the county as the jurisdiction that's taking it over. So I'll discuss the county if they want to, you know, the tax assessor with the county be the one that redistributes or whatever, or if we need to kind of appoint someone outside as the trustee, but I'll certainly bring that up with the county.
Right, and who the trustee would be and how that person would be appointed or group or whatever it is you ended up deciding to use. Does that prompt any other questions? Representative Vance?
Thank you. So is the county going to step in and assume anything, or is it limited? Are the county's responsibilities limited to those called out somewhere? There's nobody to have an agreement with, is the point, right? I mean, the city of Damascus goes away, so the only thing that the county really has right now is this pile of money. And so if I was the county, if I was the county's attorney, I'd be very worried right now. I'd try to find somebody else to do all the work. It's so dangerous.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, first of all, the county attorney has been he's actually come to Salem and been in the negotiations with us, so he's bringing up a lot of these issues. There are some intergovernmental agreements they're currently in with West Lynn, is who Damascus is in some intergovernmental agreements with, that obviously those will go away. So we're parsing out right now the difference between things that are actually the city's responsibilities that will get put to the county and the things that are simply on contract that, you know, whether the contract has to be, you know, fulfilled for a certain period of years, or whether the contract can go away. Like their city attorney, for example, the Damascus city attorney is actually on contract. He's not employed. So that, and they've looked, and that's a contract that can end when the city ends. And so that's kind of part of the complication of what we're working out with the city. But definitely, it definitely is the county that's the kind of the takeover jurisdiction. All of this land just becomes unincorporated Clackamas. Therefore, the next level of government is the county. And so that's kind of – and their city attorney has been the one actually initiating the conversations with us, and then also in the room negotiating, as well as their lobbyists.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today? We look forward to the amendments.
All right. Thank you.
With that, we'll close the – public hearing on House Bill 3086. Colleagues, we're going to stand at ease for a few minutes while I deal with a slightly different issue. The committee will stand at ease. Don't wander off. We're doing? Okay. The Committee on Revenue will come back to order. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2961, and Paul is going to describe it for us.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you heard House Bill 2961 several weeks ago. It was proposed a mechanism for putting set-aside dollars into the statutory rainy day fund. The Dash 1 that you have before you is a complete replacement for that, for the original 2961, but it's still a reserve fund bill, and what it does is establish a different mechanism for putting money in reserves. There are several pieces to it. It involves a calculation done by Department of Revenue. And I just stop here for a minute and say this, you may want to review this and think that we've got Department of Revenue estimating what capital gains revenue is. Maybe we want to ask DAS to do that. And that's something you can think about as a state economist, maybe doing that calculation. But the way it's set up now, Department of Revenue is going to estimate the average amount of revenue received from personal income taxes due to taxable capital gains. So that calculation is going to be done by May 15 of an odd-numbered year, and that's going to look at the three consecutive years prior to the year calendar year preceding the start of the biennium. So if we're in May of 2015 right now, Department of Revenue would estimate capital gains income tax revenue for 2010, 2011, 2012, and calculate the average. Then by June 15 of 2017, if this law were in effect, by June 15 of 2017, the Department of Revenue will come back and look at the two preceding years, 13 and 14. These are estimates, though, because we don't have full return data, and estimate capital gains revenue associated with those 2 years. There would be an annual average calculation. The 13-14 number would be compared with the 10-11-12 number, the annual average. And then if there's an excess, if the 13-14 number exceeds the three prior years in capital gains revenue, that excess times 2 would be put into the Education Stability Fund, the Constitutional Education Stability Fund. The mechanism for doing that, the language, in fact, your preceding bill, 2070, and also in Senate Bill 129, has the Department of Revenue retaining unreceded revenue. This would use that same language. So the Department of Revenue would retain that revenue, make an estimate, and then at the end of the biennium those dollars would be put in the Education Stability Fund. The way the bill is set up now in terms of its timing, the first calculation would be done in 2017, in June of 2017, prior to the end of the 15-17 biennium. And just to show you a couple of things, if you look at capital gains income, my capital gains income chart, this, I think you've seen this before, but picture's worth a thousand words, and you can see the roller coaster ride. This coincides almost precisely with the ups and downs the legislature experienced in the 2001-03 period, the 2002 collapse, and the high-tech bubble in the stock market, and then of course the Great Recession, which pushed capital gains income revenue down from about over $8 billion down to $2 billion in a year. So this is the kind of volatility you have from the capital gains revenue. So what I did was I took the history of capital gains revenue and put them in a, well, I can't see that, but you should be able to see the one in front of you, I think.
Yep. That's document 64351.
Yeah. Well, you should be.
It's called a copy of capital gains revenue history.
Yeah. So, I can blow that up a little bit. On my spreadsheet, I made you can see the important numbers there I've identified are in red. And this calculation, you can see there's a three-year average and a two-year average. So you're comparing that two-year average with the three-year average from the three preceding years. And if you look, and that's the excess revenue calculation. And if you look at that, we have an excess revenue column. We have a sum column, which sums up the incremental revenue from that biennium with the balance from before. And you can see that during the long bull market in the 80s and 90s, pretty steady gains in the fund. There was excess revenue, but that's because capital gains revenue was growing pretty steadily. And that was up until 1999. And then with the collapse in the stock market, you can see that by that time, the additional revenue in the Education Stability Fund, which of course didn't exist at that time, but it was a little over $1 billion. So that would have been available for to cover a shortfall. And the last column there is the general fund forecast deviation. So the deviation between the close of session and actual revenue for 2001-03 was about $1.7 billion. So you would have had an additional $1 billion to cover the $1.7 billion if you just looked at that direct comparison. Capital gains recovered strongly following the 2001-02 collapse, and the fund then quickly gets back up to about $688 million. Interestingly, in the 2009 period, this would be in the spring of 2009, you would actually have had some excess revenue of about $50 million. And the reason for that is you're looking at 2007-08, which was before the Great Recession really took hold, against the three prior years, which included the weak period in the early 2000s. So you do have a slight excess, in spite of the fact you have a $1.3 billion shortfall in your revenue forecast. Of course, having access to the Education Stability Fund, you would have exceeded the triggers during that period, both the employment trigger and the budget trigger. And then in the 2009-11 biennium, you can see that there would be, with the drop-off in capital gains revenue, the shortfall of about $1 billion, you'd have that $738 million, which would be dollars that would potentially be available to fund that. Where you would be right now if we were in 2015 and we were doing this calculation based on the current forecast, we'd estimate excess revenue about $450 million, and that would add to the $200 million from last biennium, and you would have, and of course we're about $358 million above the forecast. This is not the kicker calculation. This is corporate and is all general fund revenue. So that 450 would be go into the Education Stability Fund at the end of this biennium and would give you about $653 million from this source going into 15-17.
In the Stability Fund.
Yes. In addition, you would have the lottery dollars as well.
Right. Okay. Representative Reed, did you want to talk about this one?
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say thanks to Paul for great work here. As we talked about when we heard 2961 and another one that I talked about, the interest for me is to address the volatility, and the capital gains obviously are among the very most volatile of our revenue streams. So I very much like the idea of smoothing some of those very jagged peaks and putting those dollars into our reserve funds so that they're available when we're short. The fact that it is so volatile means it's difficult, I think, to figure out the right way to do that. And I think Paul has done a very good job of constructing the right mechanism to do that in a way that recognizes that volatility and puts it in the reserve fund. The Education Stability Fund, as we all know, is constitutional. It has a series of specific triggers that allow it to be accessed, what is also true is that it cannot, I think I'm right on this, only two-thirds of whatever is there can be accessed in any one biennium, so it really is a long-term reserve fund, and I think that would be a very good thing for us as we try to escape what feels to me like the roller coaster of trying to cut and recover from cuts and be able to think about much longer-term strategies. So I hope we can adopt the amendment and move it forward.
One other thing, Mr. Chair, I would add, and a technical issue, is the current Education Stability Fund is capped at 5% of general fund revenue in the prior biennium. So that may be something you want to review. If the revenue exceeds that, it goes into the school capital matching fund. So it would go into a capital fund if you accumulated more than the 5%.
But if we wanted to, we could write a provision that said, if we're reaching the cap, any additional funds from this source would go into a different reserve. Couldn't we do that?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. This would be, even though it's a constitutional fund, and once it gets in the fund, you have to abide by the constitutional limitations, but the revenue source itself is statutory.
Right.
So you could modify that.
So you don't have to modify the constitutional rule in order to deal with some other reserve account if you decided to do that for the overflow.
Yes, that's correct.
And Mr. Chair, just to jump back in, we've talked about this in broad terms. The other reserve fund we have, which in most respects mirrors the Educational Stability Fund, is the statutory rainy day fund. That might well be a good source. You and I were both on the Revenue Stabilization Task Force load these many years ago. We talked about
it does seem like yesterday, doesn't it?
It does. which we talked about, a 15% kind of combined reserve. So that, as I recall, the statutory rainy day fund is more like 10. So we could get that as a second source.
Thank you.
Second destination.
I appreciate the reminder. After a lot of work, that group did decide that 15% was sort of the minimum amount that was prudent.
To cover 90% of the big recessions,
Of the big variance. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Reed and Paul, for your work on this. Just two questions maybe for staff. First is, what effect, if any, would this have on the kicker? And the second being, does this effectuate a revenue transfer such that further action of the legislature would be necessary to transfer this? Or would it be a true revenue transfer that doesn't require any further legislative action?
Representative Davis, the transfer piece would be contained in the statute, much like the bill, the gain share bill.
Yeah.
We'd have that same kind of provision, and so it is using that. In fact, that same language that mm-hmm. is in the new versions of the gain share. So that would not require it. The issue of around its interaction with a kicker. There are several things that come into play. One is the way this is worded, this revenue would not touch the general fund, so it would not be considered a general fund going in. It would go to the Ed Stability Fund, so it would not stay within the statutory rainy day fund, so it couldn't be accessed easily. The remaining argument around the kicker is the notion that personal income revenue is, by its very nature, general fund, because that was the predominant source of revenue at the time voters put the kicker language in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So that would be the one remaining issue of whether it was calculated in the kicker or not. The only really court decisions we have was one in 2001 after the Medicaid upper payment limit, the MUPL money was put in, and we had the Bobo versus Kitzhaber decision, which said that fund shifts were allowed, but that was not an income tax mm-hmm. revenue source. So mm-hmm. that would be the remaining issue that would have to be decided on whether the kicker, how the kicker was treated.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another brief question for Dr. Warner. Just looking at the chart that you made of the capital gains revenue, were there any significant legislative changes in the mid-90s? Because you do have that kind of slow, steady uptick. So it was just the hugely volatile stock market and not any other, like, state legislative changes at that time as far as our tax policy went?
That's correct, Representative. But, there were the biggest income tax change that had a broad effect. There were several of them. One in the early 80s, there was a period, we had a higher rate structure peaking at 10% at that time. And during the recession of the early 80s, the legislature imposed, it's called a surcharge, but it was a rate increase was put in by the 82 special session, which bumped the top rate up to 10.8. So now when you look at this revenue, what I did was I plugged in an assumed tax rate on this income. The income here is data, but this revenue is generated by my assumed average rate. For most capital gains, it's near the top marginal rate. But I, for example, during that period of the so-called surcharge, instead of 10.8, I plugged in 10.5, so assuming that rate did. So I did adjust for the rate changes. The only other change was back in 87, when the legislature adopted the federal changes that had broadened the base considerably. But that really didn't affect capital gains much. Some of the federal changes around capital gains rate encourage people to realize more capital gains in certain periods, and we were the beneficiary of that in terms of revenue. But those were federal changes and not state ones. But really, the volatility comes in the 2000s, and you can see that just looking at the income levels and how it grew during the period where it's up for 2007, for example, grew over $9 billion. So there was a huge surge in capital gains revenue coming in for taxpayers, and that's what really drove a lot of it. And then when you got shifts, those percentage shifts is what generated such big revenue numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to be heard today on House Bill, 2961, is that it?
Yes.
2961? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2961, and the committee will stand at ease. Just a very short one, I think. Thank you. The committee will come back to order. We'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2070. Representative Whitsitt.
Mr. Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move the committee reconsider the vote by which the Dash 1 amendments failed to pass on House Bill 2070.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt moves the committee reconsider the vote by which it failed to adopt the Dash 1 amendments on House Bill 2070. Representative Whitsitt, do you want to be heard on the motion?
Yes, I'd like to change my vote, please.
Yes, okay. That explains it. This motion is debatable. It requires a simple majority vote for passage. Is there any further debate on the motion?
We are in a work session.
We are in a work session on House Bill 2070, yeah. I think we need to call the roll. And the motion is on the motion to reconsider. A yes vote means the vote by which we failed to pass the Dash 1 amendment will be reconsidered, and we'll be back on that motion. A no vote is contrary. Please.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Leininger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt.
Aye.
Representative Megan Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Bentz.
No.
Chair Barnhart.
Chair votes aye. Motion to reconsider passes, and we're back on the Dash 1 amendment, which was earlier moved. Is there any further debate on the Dash 1 amendment? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote on the Dash 1 amendment. Again, a yes vote is to adopt the amendment. A no vote is otherwise contrary. Please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Leininger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
No.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt.
Aye.
Representative David Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Bentz.
No.
Chair Barnhart.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Representative Vega Peterson.
Chair Barnhart, I move House Bill 2070 as amended. With the due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson moves House Bill 2070 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the recommendation of a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there further discussion? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank both leadership in the House and the Senate for looking into gain share in quite some depth. I'll oppose this motion to move this down to Ways and Means. I think we already have a great vehicle down in Ways and Means with the Senate version. We're having a very good discussion that will continue. So for that reason, I will oppose this.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will also be a no. I suspect that the motion will pass, and when it goes to the Ways and Means Committee, it seems to me that there's a lot more discussion to be had. I do prefer the work of the work group from the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, support the bipartisan, bicameral gain share solution that's been put forward by this legislature. A couple of components that I really value in that bill. One is that provides some certainty to CTE, which we all talk about a great deal. We talk about economic growth. We talk about workforce development. And We've got a great plan in place. It would help to facilitate some effort there. Secondly, the support for the statewide, I think, is absolutely critical in my neck of the woods, in my part of the state. And once you get outside of the greenway here, as I refer to it, as those statewides are an absolutely critical part of our economic growth and agri business in Oregon. And I'm really sorry to see that go away with the passage of this bill. So I'll be voting no.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I will be supporting this motion. I think that it's important that we have a really robust conversation about the issue of gain share and how it impacts our state in all geographic regions. We know that we have a lot of needs of the state, and I think we could use every dollar that we can get in order to support things like education.
Thank you. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I will be supporting this bill. I think we need to make sure that we have enough revenue for schools. We've spent a lot of time talking about making sure we fund our K through 12 system adequately, and I think by making sure we don't over send tax revenue to some jurisdictions who've had the good fortune of attracting significant employers, we can make sure that there is funding available for schools and other core services.
Thank you. Other discussion? Let me simply note, Representative Johnson, that all of the issues you raise and where we could spend money, I completely agree with. We definitely need the statewide services. We definitely need the technical education piece that you referred to and other things. And, of course, the Ways and Means Committee's job is to figure that stuff out. And I'm happy to join you with lobbying for those things in the budget. I appreciate it. Call the roll, please. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Woodsit, please.
I would like to say also that I intend to be part of the conversation in Ways and Means on this bill, and that I fully support any number of the things that were brought forward in the discussion in the Senate, and hopefully we will find funding for everything that we need. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's call the roll. Again, the motion is to send the bill on to the Ways and Means Committee. A yes vote is to do that. A no vote is contrary.
Representative
with
Davis.
A due pass. Sorry, with a due pass. Go ahead.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
No.
Representative Smith-Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye. The motion carries, and the bill will go on to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2070. Colleagues, we have one more public hearing to hold today, and that is the public hearing on House Bill 3020, which we open now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3020 would direct the Legislative Revenue Office to conduct a study of the structure that is used for timber tax in the state and the revenue that comes from it. And so the it would have an eye toward making the timber tax revenue in Oregon equivalent to timber tax revenue in neighboring states. It would require the Legislative Revenue Officer to report the results of the study on or before September 15th, 2016. So that would be to the interim revenue committees. There are a number of different tax structures for timber in neighboring states, most notably severance taxes or privilege taxes for harvest are a bit more prevalent in other states and at a larger rate. And so part of the equivalence of timber revenues would have to do with the amount of harvest and I guess a study would contemplate the variability in timber harvest and the stability of the revenue sources. And to make it equivalent to timber tax in other states, it would require that not be subject to variability that other states are not experiencing.
Thank you. Paul, this bill orders you to do stuff. Do you want to be heard?
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I plan to be on vacation this interim, and Christine will do the work now. This is an issue that we, of course, had a long history of being involved in, and we haven't taken a real comprehensive look at it for a while, but it would certainly be something we would consider within our purview. We would see it as really a direction from you. I think it's something we could handle within our existing budget, so I wouldn't see a fiscal impact from it. This kind of a measure just tells us what you think is important, and then that's a way for us to prioritize. So that would be how we'd view it. And Christine did spend some time this last interim updating our timber taxation research piece that she went through with you, and this would be a natural extension of that.
Thank you. Questions for Dr. Warner? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, lots of work done on this, and we've heard a lot about it, or at least I have over the years. And there must have been some dramatic changes since the early 2000s to warrant are we looking at this. Tell us what those are.
Representative Benz, I don't know if it's so much dramatic changes from the early 2000s. I think it's more the change that occurred that preceding period, which would be especially with the passage of Measure 5, which the interpretation that the severance taxes were within the Measure 5 limits, and therefore there had to be an adjustment. We went through a period of a privilege tax, and then in 99 and 2001, this committee spent a lot of time on making a transition to more of a property tax system, with only the small woodlands being subject to the severance tax. So that transition took place at that time. There's been relative stability since then, but we haven't really stepped back and look at the current system now, how it's operated over the last 15 years and how it compares with what other states have done. And that's my interpretation of the direction from this study.
And a follow-up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
So the states that you think that we're asking you to compare us to are which?
Representative Vance, I think that there may be not a specific set of states, but I think obviously the neighboring states would be a good example, particularly Washington and California, that have a large forest products industry. We could even go extend beyond that and look at some of the provincial tax policies as well that affect timber, because particularly British Columbia is a major producer.
Thank you. Those states have, or enjoy, if that's the right word, a consumption taxes that might have an impact on how they choose to tax crops such as timber. Your study will, of course, address that, I'm sure, so that we understand how that weighs into their decision making and how they choose to approach the taxation of timber. The reason I raise the issue, of course, is they get one shot at it, perhaps, or more. I'm not sure how it works. But I guess in Washington, no income tax, so they must be a little more reliant upon their property taxes up there than we are. Is that a proper statement? Or more to the point, I'm not asking you to give us a study now. I just want to make sure we hear about it in your study.
Yes, absolutely, Representative Benz. The study that I can think of that would be not the subject area, but kind of some of the methodology, is a study we completed right before the last legislative session. Was on competitiveness of our taxation of manufacturing facilities. And so in that study, I mean, obviously when we're looking at other states, we're looking at tax incentives, we're looking at corporate tax, we looked at the apportionment formulas, and we also factored in sales taxes on materials in particular. So if, for example, you're manufacturing wood products, a lot of your inputs could potentially be subject to sales tax. So we'd be looking at those types of methods in which not so much the overall taxes, but how it affects the specific industry, and to be able to compare and make that comparison where you'd look at the different taxes that the individual states rely on.
One final.
Yes, please.
And the thing that I've noticed in my part of the world is the drought conditions are seriously damaging the forests. And the old concepts of having a crop there that is predictable are being turned upside down,
yeah,
either because of fire or because stuff just isn't growing as fast as it once did because there's no water. And so how that affects this side of the state, I'm not really sure. But that element of increased risk and reduced production needs to be on the table somehow, because it certainly is a change that's worthy of our consideration.
I would agree completely, Representative Bentz. Of course, we have traditionally, back the days of the severance tax, had a different rate structure for Eastern and Western Oregon, and for some of those reasons. But as you say, the kinds of changes we've seen in the environment since we made these significant changes 15 years ago have had a huge impact. And the environment, and I mean that not the all terms, all uses of the term environment, has changed dramatically since then, and that should be factored in that for context purposes. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Other questions for Paul? Thank you. I have three witnesses signed up. Link Cannon, Roger Beyer, and Bill Kluting. And I'm sorry to have not left you much time, but I suspect it won't take very much, given that this is a pretty simple bill.
Go ahead, Link. I think you're first.
All right. Thanks. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Lincoln Cannon. I'm the Director of Forest Resources and Taxation for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I've brought you, left with staff, a 2015-2016 version of the OFREE Forest Factsbook. I don't know if you have that. If you don't, we were remiss in not getting it to you a long time ago. It's a great little handbook of laws and economic effects and ownerships and that sort of thing in Oregon. So that's just some background information. As to the bill, 3020 requires legislative revenue officer to study changes necessary to make timber tax revenue in Oregon equivalent to timber tax revenue in neighboring states. I was encouraged to hear Dr. Warner and Representative Bentz talk about the scope of that, because this seems pretty specific. Timber tax revenues is a fairly specific term, and neighboring states is a fairly specific term. So based on that language, I would say first, neighboring states do not have uniform timber tax policies. All neighbors, California, Washington, and Idaho, all tax forest land under an ad valorem tax system. However, on the harvest tax side, Washington has a 5% severance tax on harvested timber in the west, and they have a different rate in the east that I don't recollect. California has a 3.2% tax and a 1.8% severance tax, and that's on the value of the timber harvested. Those are stumpage values. Oregon has the forest products harvest tax, which is $3.43 per 1,000 board feet. So this is, instead of a value-based tax, a volume-based tax. And Idaho has no tax on harvested timber at all. So if you were to go strictly looking at those as timber taxes and try to compare those and compare how Oregon stacks up, you're going to get very different answers from each state. And I would say further, and this is again to the point that Representative Benson and Mr. Warner, Dr. Warner discussed, timber tax only comparisons aren't relevant. You ignore the overall differences in tax structures between the states, and such studies would produce a distorted and inaccurate picture of the total forest sector contribution to public revenues. The one obvious example of that, which has already been mentioned, is the tax treatment of income in Oregon and Washington. Washington doesn't have an income tax rate, or doesn't have an income tax. Oregon does, and it's pretty high. And according to calculations by the Department of Forestry, income taxes generated by the forest sector contribute over $170 million to state coffers. Washington doesn't have that revenue source. They have sales taxes. And again, this goes to the broader scope of how difficult this kind of a study would be. Oregon landowners also pay taxes and fees that are not levied in other states, such as for fire protection and weight mile taxes for transportation and others. The total contribution to the state from the forest sector is estimated by the Department of Forestry to be $450 million. So we believe the level of timber taxation is a policy question for the legislature, not a research question for LRO necessarily, and it should be considered in the context of Oregon, not in the context of Washington or California or Idaho. And what share, what equitable share do we, does this sector bear relative to other sectors and other taxpayers in the state of Oregon? I would note, kind of in closing, and this is kind of how I close everything these days, 35% of Oregon forest land is in private ownership, which produces nearly 80% of the total annual harvest in the state. 60% of Oregon's forest land is in federal ownership, which produces only 13% of the total harvest in this state. The number one thing you can do to create revenue for government is increase timber harvest. And the main place that needs to happen is on federal lands. And we know, you know, how easy that is to do for state government. But it's something, you know, with the collaboratives, there are efforts afoot. There's legislation in Washington. And if we can ever get federal forests back to a reasonable level of management, the revenues, the income tax revenues, would be substantial, and it would help rural communities. And incidentally, there's a lot of environmental benefits. We discussed the fire risk, the carbon emissions associated with fires, catastrophic wildfires. If we could get back in the forest, manage that, produce jobs, reduce that, you know, it's a win-win-win. But we don't believe the study is necessary or even helpful in getting us where we need to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing Oregon Small Woodlands Association. You have on OLIS testimony from Jim James, Executive Director of Oregon Small Woodlands, and also from Gilbert Shibley, a small woodland owner from Clackamas County. Both were here the first time this bill was scheduled for hearing, but were unable to make it back today. So we have submitted their testimony to you. I won't read that testimony, just point out a couple things about it, things you probably already know. Oregon has about approximately 140,000 small woodland owners, and those would be people who qualify as small woodland owners that's owning between 10 and 5,000 acres of timberland. Oregon Small Woodlands Association has about 3,000 members, and we own, and those small woodland owners own about 42% of the private woodland in Oregon. We're opposed to this bill. We think it's, quite frankly, a waste of time, and comparing the taxes in between the different states would actually make no sense at all. You just heard from Mr. Cannon many of the reasons why that is, but one he didn't address is one that Jim James put in his letter. I'd just like to highlight that. We in Oregon, the timberland owners, are required by state law to grow timber on that property. None of the other states have that requirement. We can't pick up our tree farms and move them to California, Washington, or Idaho, even if we wanted to. And quite, you know, also the opposite is true. People in California, Washington, or Idaho can't pick up their tree farms and move them to Oregon. But only the growers in Oregon are required by state law to use those our tree farms for the purpose of growing and harvesting forest products. The other people in other states can use those lands for other purposes. So we don't think that it would be a fair comparison or a necessary comparison to talk about what neighboring states are doing to their forest land owners. In addition to that, just the bill seems to presuppose an outcome by its wording to say that the taxes should receive an Oregon equivalent to the revenue from timber taxes in neighboring states. We don't believe that's an appropriate verbiage to use. If you want to look at taxes from other states and how other states tax their timber, that's a different question than making proposals to make our taxes equivalent. We believe that presupposes an outcome, and that's another reason we oppose this bill as drafted. Also like to point out, and this is good work done by Mr. Greg Miller of Weyerhaeuser Company, when this bill was introduced. I think he told me it took him about 15 minutes on the internet to come up with multiple studies that have already done this. So to spend state resources to do what is already available in a 15-minute search on the internet seems like a somewhat of a waste of time. So I'd just like to put that on the record. I don't know if Mr. Miller submitted those websites to you for your use, but he has those available to him. If you would ask him, I sure be happy to share them with you. With that, Mr. Chair, you know, the testimony from Mr. Shipley is also on the record. Please take a look at it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that part of the reason why we may not have a fiscal may be because those studies are already available. Appreciate it. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, Committee for the Record, Bill Clothing, Carpenters Industrial Council. When I first read this bill, it's so short, and it doesn't really say too much which way we're going to go. But I will say I got 4,000 members in this state that work off private timber. The taxing program has worked for quite a few years. I would hate to see something opened up to where we run into problems where our private owners are hurt. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, colleagues, for your patience. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I don't know what you guys did this session to put a bullseye on your back, but apparently you've done something because folks are looking at you as the cash cow to balance the budget. So, but anyway, what would you think about LRO or someone doing a study on how we might improve or increase timber harvest to actually provide greater input to our state coffers and do it through the supply side rather than the taxation side?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thanks for the question. There are multiple efforts out there doing that already, and you know, LRO could bring those to you, but there's the whole state lands discussion is ongoing now within the legislature, and the value of those resources that are not being realized and what the appropriate level of that is. And then, of course, in addition to that, the federal issue is just intractable. We know how much is there, and we know how much could be there. I would refer you in that little booklet I gave you. There is a page, and I don't have one in front of me, so I can't tell you the page number, but it shows the net growth and net removals on private forest lands and public forest lands. And in fact, there is more mortality on public forest lands than there are net removals. So mm-hmm. of the timber that's being removed, they're not even removing all the dead trees. So, you know, that's... Again, and people understand that, and the problem is the web of legislation and court decisions that essentially make that impossible. But yeah, I mean, if LRO collected all of that, that'd be great. I don't think they need to do a study more than that. It's a literature search and data collection effort.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, if I could respond to that also very briefly.
Very briefly, we're already 3 minutes over our time.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. If this committee wanted to take up an issue that the timber industry greatly needs, is to try to figure out how to rebuild the infrastructure on the east side. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter how high of a severance tax, if you put it based on a percentage of volume or even by a percentage of value or volume, if they're harvesting zero, the return is still zero. And on the east side, the value of our small woodland owners' members on that side is almost zero now if they do harvest, because the trucking costs and logging costs eat up any value that might be in the timber. So if this committee wants to conduct a study that would be valuable to the timber industry and to increasing tax revenues, it would be figuring out how to get the infrastructure back on the east side and how to get a log supply into that infrastructure. Because right now the infrastructure is gone in eastern Oregon. It is simply non-existent. People who want to harvest timber have to truck their logs on average probably 150 miles, and that just completely eats up the value of anything that might have been there. So thank you for that question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your testimony today. We appreciate it. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3020. Colleagues, thank you for your patience on a busy day. The committee is adjourned. Oh. I need to tell you, don't forget tomorrow morning, 8:30. Tomorrow morning, 8:30, we meet as the Joint Tax Committee with the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue.
I can still not do much.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
If you had me there.